Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network known as Blog Talk Radio. Gosh, no rain, no snow. It's absolutely gorgeous outside. I think the Midwest might be seeing spring before too long. We're keeping our fingers crossed. Have a tremendous show tonight. Old friend Ken Owen will be joining us, Executive Media Director of DePaul University. And we're going to talk about, well, I mentioned a couple folks that he's actually interviewed Paul McCartney, so right there's a show in itself, and some of his adventures. And also, he just might be North America's number one Todd Rundgren fan, and he'll be with us in just a few moments. Of course, handling the technical responsibilities, Melissa Hovey and Wayne Larson, and our musical director, Jim Johnson. And from his Wild World News studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson.
Well, it's a calm before the storm. They say we're going to get all this rain tonight.
Yeah, supposedly by the weekend we're supposed to have about 3 inches. Like we need it.
We're going to build an ark. I have to tell you, though, this, I know now spring's just around the corner because the bears have come out of their lair. Now, I haven't seen the bears too much for about 3 weeks because of all this foul, frigid weather we've had. But the last day or so, they've been out wandering around looking for something to eat. So,
and I bet they're hungry.
They are hungry. But, you know, they didn't lose that much weight over the winter. They don't eat, you know, there's the old fallacy how bears hibernate, where they don't really hibernate. They just don't like bad weather. So they have the capabilities of eating so much in the fall. They have such a fat base that they can survive on that throughout the winter with basically just sleeping, but they're not truly hibernating.
I'd like to live a bear's life then.
Yeah, I would too, just sleep through all the nasty weather we've had. The following portion of Larry Batson's Wild World is brought to you by Alphabet Swamp, the new children's book by Cheryl and Larry Batson. That's right. Order your autographed copy today at www.larrytheanimalguy.com or send check or money order for $10 per copy to WES 4140 North, 600 West, Greencastle, Indiana, 46135. That includes shipping and handling.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening, wildlife lovers around the world. Tonight, we're going to start off in Washington, D.C.
Uh-oh.
The National Zoo has acquired Leek, a one-year-old male Asian fishing cat. Now, zoo biologist Erica Bauer said Leek will be mated with Electra, the zoo's only female fishing cat, though the endangered cats are terribly difficult to breed in captivity. Well, like, you know, most things that you pull out of the wild. The Leek
right.
is on exhibit at the Asia Trail. Now, the cats can swim, dive for food, or they scoop fish from the water with their paws, which are partially webbed. Now, you're familiar with the Asian fishing cats, aren't you?
Yes, I have had the opportunity to work with them and take care of them many years ago, before they were as nearly as endangered as they are now. They're very secretive cats, so to get them to breed in captivity, that's going to be quite an undertaking, but we hope the Washington Zoo has some good luck with that.
Amen.
Yep.
All right. Idaho Falls, Idaho. Two black-footed penguins from the Idaho Falls Zoo are heading south. Penguin keeper Amy Vargas says the penguins are going to the Dallas Zoo to be part of an education and outreach program. Zoo workers and volunteers have worked with the birds to make sure they're comfortable around people. Now, the zoo will still have about 20 penguins, so make sure you stop in and see them. And they'll be back before you know it. Now,
well,
I was thinking...
What's that?
That maybe if they got tennis shoes for the birds, they wouldn't be black-footed.
I have no idea what to say about that.
Okay. That
you should say you're sorry is what you should say.
I apologize for that.
You should.
All right, well, let's run off to the Windy City then.
Okay.
Chicago, Illinois.
Oh.
A rare dolphin at the Shedd Aquarium is expecting a calf in mid-May. TK is one of the few Pacific white-sided dolphins living in a zoo or an aquarium. Now, she and another female were taken to live with male dolphins for 2 years at the Miami Sea Aquarium as part of a breeding program. We're in the breeding season.
Yes.
Now, they returned just this last part of the fall. And so if you want to keep up on TK and the
mm-hmm.
new baby,
mm-hmm.
check mid-May, and there should be a new calf.
Well, let's hope there is. That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool.
Yep.
All right. Lordsburg, New Mexico. One of your favorite things, desert bighorn sheep have arrived at the Red Rock Wildlife Area. State Game and Fish Department spokesman Dan Williams says that 10 rams are in quarantine, but eventually will provide new genes to the herd they started there in the 1970s. Now, the rams came in exchange for pronghorn antelope, which were sent to areas there in New Mexico.
Well, that's pretty cool. I've had the opportunity to see the desert bighorn sheep in the Badlands in the Dakotas. And
quite
you know,
impressive animals.
Oh, and they're hard to spot because in that terrain they just blend right in so well. So we saw them through binoculars. We didn't see them with the naked eye, but pretty amazing.
Pretty beautiful animals.
Yep.
Okay, I got some good and bad news for you now.
Oh.
Fort Worth, Texas.
Yeah.
Almost extinct after being hunted and trapped for pelts in the 1800s, beavers are reemerging as a gnawing problem in North Texas. Now, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram reports that the beavers are destroying trees in parks, golf courses, subdivisions, wherever there's a chewy tree to chew on.
Yep. Well, that's what they do, and apparently they're doing a fine job of it. So I'm on the beaver side. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I am too.
Yep.
So they're just going to have to deal with it.
That's right.
All right, now here's a story we reported on last week. Now, let's hope that our program had something to do with this.
Okay.
U.S. territory Guam. The island Senate passed a bill Thursday banning the sale, possession, and distribution of shark fins. Senate Vice Speaker B.J. Cruz said the Pacific Islands continue to lead the world in the fight for shark conservation. Now, every year, up to 73 million sharks are killed, primarily for their fins. Now, California, Oregon, and Washington State are working on the same banning. Now, Hawaii banned the shark fin possession last year. So let's hope this takes off.
Well, let's hope it does, and I assume that the states that you talked about, Washington, Oregon, California, it will. But here's the problem. This also occurs throughout the coastal countries in Central America, Mexico, and, of course, South America. And it's really our good friend Billy Sandifer from Padre Island, Texas, talked about this months ago and how it's just it's a horrible, horrible, horrible crime, and it should be. But, you know, let's one step at a time, let's get taken care of here in the States, and maybe we can convince other countries to do the same.
Agreed.
Yep.
All right. Now, you have a couple of large wolves that live at your compound.
Mm-hmm.
Well, call them in because they're going to want to hear this story.
Uh-oh.
When is it okay to cry wolf?
Well,
when you're at Wolf Park.
Okay.
Now, they have howl nights at Wolf Park at Battleground, Indiana, which is about 7 miles north of Lafayette, Indiana. Now, you've heard wolves howl at the sight of the moon. Well, head to Wolf Park and see for yourself. Howl Nights offer visitors an opportunity to see the wolves at play. Visitors are separated from the four-legged crooners by a six-foot fenced enclosure and are encouraged to howl and wait for the wolves to howl back. Now, the Wolf Park is a nonprofit organization that conducts behavioral research and education to improve the lives of wolves, both in captivity and in the wild.
That's Dr. Klinghammer's group up there, and it's pretty fantastic. You go out there, and the wolves are with the buffalo, and they do howl. We can make our wolves howl. Sometimes it's a good thing and sometimes it's a bad, but it's a pretty amazing song, I'll tell you.
Now, outdoors, I've met your wolves, and they are quite beautiful creatures. Chloe, yeah. And Blake, is that right?
That's right.
All right, well, that's the Wild World News for tonight.
Well, you hit it out of the park, Dr. Henry Day. We'd like to thank Dr. Henry Day for bringing us the Wild World News, brought to you by our brand-new book, Alphabet Swamp. Go to the website, www.larrytheanimalguy.com. We also, big thank you to McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. God's Country, go to their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. Also, a big thank you to RadioMom.fm, and the home of the Radio Mom Shop, where you can save 50, 60, 70% on vacations, restaurants, and a variety of other goods and services. And hey, you can listen to my show every Sunday, the 70s on Sunday, 12 to 7, at RadioMom.fm. Those are some of our underwriters. They make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
Tell everyone that I am sorry, truly sorry, for all of the wrongs I've done. I never meant to hurt nobody, no. Lord, I never want to do no wrong.
One of the most beautiful songs ever written, one of the most beautiful songs ever recorded. Very special occasion. Todd Rundgren, because we probably have probably the number one Todd Rundgren fan in the world. Executive director of DePaul University in scenic and beautiful Greencastle, Indiana, Ken Owen joins us tonight. Good night. Good evening, Ken.
That was a quick show.
I couldn't cut. That song is fantastic.
It is. You know, it was. It was obviously on the Something Anything record years ago, and Moogie Klingman, who has been battling cancer, wrote it. And about a month ago, Todd and the guys in the second incarnation of Utopia got together for the first time in something like 40 years and played in New York two gigs to help Moogie. And they played that song live, so it's
wow.
It's kind of a bucket list song. I've never heard it live before, and I may never hear it again, but it was amazing to hear it.
Well, you've been, we'll get into your real responsibilities, but you have been probably a fan, as long as I've known, you've been a Todd Rundgren fan from the beginning, I assume.
Actually, you know, I was a little late to the party. I was an admirer of Todd's music when I was a little kid, growing up in Chicago, and then really didn't get it, though, until probably the a cappella record around 1985. I think that the, you know, being a Todd Rundgren fan is not easy, and it's always interesting, but some of the left turns, I think, confused me as a kid, because I think I very much was interested in pop radio and top 40 stuff, and I knew he was capable of really writing songs like that all day long, and it always probably secretly bothered me that he just wasn't, you know, buttering the bread for us in the way we wanted it. But that's what makes him such a unique artist, I think. And I'm really just there are so many, many, many bigger Todd fans than I, but I've been privileged in my previous life in television news to be around the guy and spend a lot of time at shows and things. And so, yeah, it's an important part of who I am musically.
What's he like for the Todd Rundgren fans out there? What's he like? Now, Chasm had certain things to say. We had Chasm Sultan on the show a while back, and he basically said, "Well, it depends on what day it is."
Yeah, you know, Todd is, and Chasm's a very sweet guy.
He is.
Todd is. Todd really had a reputation in the '70s, especially, and then even the 80s with the XTC project, of being mercurial and somewhat difficult to get along with, and a perfectionist and somebody who it was his way or the highway. But I think that Todd really is he's a person that understands what he wants at all times. And I think earlier in his life, he probably wasn't as diplomatic about negotiating his way toward that conclusion, especially when he worked with some other artists. But at his core, Todd is really a nice guy. He is he's extremely, as you I'm sure know, extremely intelligent guy with a vast vocabulary and a real curiosity, but also a very short attention span. And so I've never really seen him in recent years not be a good guy, but he does tend to march to his own drum. And so he's a piece of work, but he is I can tell you that he is a very warm guy and a very funny guy, a very sarcastic guy, but I think, you know, a lot of it is it's traced back to kind of his childhood and the fact that he's done so much work on his own. I think, again, he's got an idea when he sits down to do something of what it needs to sound like, what it needs to feel like. And I think, you know, we all have elements of our lives where we're that way, and those can be difficult negotiations if that's what you do for a living and you're very rigid in the way you see things. So there are a lot of Todd stories, but I think especially in more recent years, he's mellowed a lot. I don't think he was ever a real, you know, hard ass, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But he's a very easy guy to spend time with.
He's been responsible for so much in music that a lot of people aren't even aware of his influences. In fact, one of the things that we discussed with Chasm was the I've always thought that Hall & Oates basically sound just like an extension of Todd.
Yeah, I think that Hall & Oates, and I'm a fan of them too, probably embraced the more formulaic aspects of music that Todd eschewed early in his career. And as a result, when they found formula is really a cheap way of describing something, but when they found a sound, when they found a combination that was working, they worked on that canvas for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they had a long string of hits. And Daryl Hall is a very photogenic guy too, which didn't hurt. Not that Todd's a bad looking guy, but
right.
Some of the album covers in the 70s, you know, it was almost like Todd went out of his way to look bad. And so there have been a number of things over the years that no one would want me managing them, but I probably would have done a little differently. But I think that's part of the charm of Todd is that, you know, in a way, and you're absolutely right, he is a guy that should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He doesn't want to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but he is his pedigree is at the very top of the art, and he's impacted 4 or 5 decades of music now, and yet, you know, he kind of operates on the fringes of what you might call popular success. It's always kind of flabbergasted me the people like Peter Gabriel, who is a great talent. Don't get me wrong, and I'm a fan of his too, but there was a time in the early 80s when Todd was bigger than somebody like a Peter Gabriel and probably, you know, in the same league of a David Byrne and people like that, and they all eclipsed him, I think, because he went through a period there in the 80s where he kind of retreated for a while, wasn't making music, and again, he has not been, to his credit, he has not been one to pander and one to go out and try to find ways to make people like him.
Right. He either like him or you don't. He always got the impression he really doesn't care. I mean, he loves his fans, but he just, you know, if you're not getting it.
Well, you know, I think at his core he's a soft touch. I think he does care. I think, but I think, you know, he wants you to care on his terms.
Right.
And I think one of the things he suffers from is that people may have heard a song or they may have stumbled upon something and they think that's him. And of course, every Todd Rundgren record is different. So you could like 5 Todd Rundgren records and hate 14 of them.
Yeah.
I don't think that's too possible, but you know, there probably are records in the collection that are so far removed from the stuff that really is ear candy that it takes a while to work up to it. And it really is kind of an education when you start playing the records, because some of them are just instant grabbers and some are real slow burners, and it takes a long time for them to stick to your brain.
Well, I've always thought that there's going to be one day a country music artist that's going to delve into the Todd Rundgren catalog and have about 20 hits.
I think it happened, actually. Somebody, wasn't it Hank Ketchum or somebody, covered I Saw the Light a few years ago.
They did.
Yeah.
Well, it's a fantastic catalog, and it's I'm always amazed when I talk to people younger than I, when I mention the name Todd Rundgren, and they say, who? I said, you're not familiar. You haven't, no. I said, gosh, you need to look into this. It's a vast catalog. Well, we've talked a little bit about Todd Rundgren. We want to talk about Ken Owen. You are the executive director of media at, relations at DePaul University. And you've had a chance to be with and haul around and present to DePaul several pretty well-known individuals over the last, what, how long was it, 10 years now you've been with DePaul?
Been there 10 years, a little more than 10 years. And part of my job is to, my job has a lot of different kind of branches to it, but since 2002 I've been coordinating the Timothy and Sharon Oven Lecture Series, which is a program that we put on 4 or 5 times every year that is made possible by a gift by two 1958 graduates, Tim and Sharon Oven, who years ago, 1986, decided they'd give money to DePaul, and they've given a lot of gifts to DePaul, but this particular one, they wanted to do something that would essentially bring the world to Greencastle and allow our students to interact with people who have touched the world in a number of different ways. And over the years, the guests have included people like Benazir Bhutto, Shimon Peres, Colin Powell, Margaret Thatcher, Elie Wiesel. It's really an impressive list. If you go to depaw.edu, our website, and just type in the top search box, Ubben Lecture Series, you'll find an entire roster of the. It's about 100 people now who've been to campus, and you can, if you click on any certain picture, you'll get a summary of their visit and some video clips often. So it's a way of kind of educating yourself. But I've brought Mikhail Gorbachev and Tony Blair, and we had a Karl Rove-Howard Dean debate in 2009. We've got Lee Hamilton coming on March 15th, the former congressman and the co-chair of the 9/11 Commission and Iraq Study Group, who's a DePauw graduate, class of 1952. And on March 30th, we've got Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, debating Nicholas Carr, who's got a book out called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. He also wrote an article once called, Is Google Making Us Stupid? So it should be interesting, because I think, you know, we all have gadgets, and we all, whether it's just sitting down at our laptop or fiddling around with the iPhone all day long, we're constantly in touch with people, and I think we all look at our lives and think, you know, it wasn't always this way.
No.
And you kind of, you know, as much as it's great to be in contact with people all the time and be reachable and be able to download things, there is something about going outside and looking at a tree or watching some birds.
Oh.
And we've taken some serious steps away from that kind of reflective time. And I think on the 30th we'll... you know, we'll get some messages that will make us think about that even more.
Well, one of the things, we've had several folks on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, is they are actually concerned of future generations of youngsters that don't go outside. Our future biologists and zoologists, geologists, scientists, because as you've just mentioned, these kids are imprinted to a screen, whether it be a computer, their iPhones, or whatever. And that our government is actually concerned, is absolutely concerned about that.
And with good reason, because I think, you know, you're really a product of your environment, and you can't blame kids for doing what they do. I just was on vacation, and my nephews, who are both twins, they've got one of those Nintendo, is it a DS or an ES? You see, I'm a grandpa now. I can't even tell you what it is. But they've got one of those little things, but they just sit there all day long and diddle on it, you know, knocking off whatever they do with their little ray guns, and I don't think it crosses their mind, you know, that they could be outside playing baseball or looking at girls or doing the things we did growing up. You wonder at age 18 how that affects you if you're just all the time needing stimulus.
Well, I used to say, too, I've mentioned before, that when we grew up, Ken, if we would have worn a helmet when we rode our bicycles, the kids would have beaten us up.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other subject. The whole, I have many friends that are attorneys, so if they're listening, I don't want them to come to my house banging on the door at 3 in the morning. But we are overly litigious, and the liability thing has just gone through the roof, and I think that there's a pretty wide chasm between just, you know, common sense and this kind of overprotection that sometimes seeps into our lives, and... you know, at a certain point, you know, you could tell everybody just to stay home every day, because if they leave the house, they might get hit by a car, or you know, you better not jog through your neighborhood because somebody might have a stroke behind the wheel someday and take you out. I mean, life is, at a certain point, you know, you're taking the spinner and seeing how many moves you're going to make, and it's a gamble. And we all take chances every day, whether we know it or not, and that's not to be morbid or silly, but at a certain point, you have to live your life. And not to say you drive down a mountain without a bicycle helmet on. That's probably not a good idea. But that's just one example, I think, of how we, you know, from time to time just get so overly protective about things. And but who am I to say?
Yeah, that's right. Who are we to say? Our guest tonight, Ken Owen with DePauw University. We're going to talk about all these amazing guests that have come into DePauw and things Ken is involved with. This is Blog Talk Radio, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
We're Rascal Flatts. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland-urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network known as Blog Talk Radio. Reaching around the world, a big hello to our listeners in England and Ireland, New Zealand, all across North America. Fantastic guest, a few moments, Ken Owen with DePaul University. He's the executive media director, and we're going to talk about some of the people that's come in DePaul to speak. And gosh, it's pretty impressive. We also want to thank our underwriter. Oh, before I forget, I want to mention next week on the show, Chris France, drummer with Talking Heads, is going to be on. So we'll be talking music once again. Chris France, Talking Heads, next week on Larry Batson's Wild World. Want to thank our underwriter, Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina, Lake Marion and Lake Moultrie. Known as Santee Cooper Lakes, 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline. Fantastic fishing, amazing golf. Go to their website, www.santeecoopercountry.org. And also a big thank you to Peter and Kathy Weimer. We Want You Cottages, way up there in western New York. Visit today their fantastic resort on the banks of Chautauqua Lake, and their addition to their website, iKids Fishing, promoting getting youngsters interested in the fantastic sport of fishing. That website is www.wewantyou.com. So, Ken, are you a fisherman?
I've had a rod in my hand in my lifetime, and it's been a long time. My dad, who passed away in August of 2009, was a pretty avid fisherman, but he threw everything back.
He did.
Loved to be out with a rod, but yeah, just threw everything back. And I admire that because yes. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I guess I'm sure there are people in your audience that are going to cringe and probably reach for some other website after they hear this, but you know, when you grow up on the south side of Chicago, unless you work in the packing plants, you think that a hamburger just comes in one of those styrofoam containers. You know, you don't put together the fact that it once was roaming around and chewing on grass.
Right.
And I don't know, there's something sad about watching a fish flop around trying to take his last few breaths. That won't keep me from eating a piece of salmon if it's put in front of me now, but I don't know, there's just the whole fisherman thing. I love being on the water. I love being with friends. It's a great environment just to catch up with people and socialize, but the you know, if I catch a fish, and I think the last time I fished was probably 15 years ago, it's going right back in the water.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it should be nowadays. In fact, there's areas in Canada where that's every lake, you catch and release. Let's set it free the moment you caught it. Now, you had mentioned Mikhail Gorbachev when he came into DePaul. I have to know what that was like. That had to be pretty.
Well, it's a pretty amazing thing. There's about eight stories I could tell, but I'll tell you that the day of the event, I got a call in the morning from Miami of Ohio, where he'd been the day before, and I think he was in the U.S. for like 4 days, so he visited three or four places, and two of them happened to be schools. But the guy who does what I do at Miami called me and warned me, essentially, that he said, this guy, you know, if you've got an hour set aside for the speech, he's going to go an hour 20, and if he, if you've got 25 minutes set aside for a news conference, he's going to go 45. And when you're in the business of planning an event, of course, the problem is that he's only going to be on the ground in Greencastle, Indiana for X number of time and X amount of time. And the longer he dallies around at the first event, the second event gets truncated. And then by the end of the day, you know, the last meeting, which was going to be meeting with some key alums in a, like a social hour thing, that was going to basically be 5 minutes because he just kept, you know, dragging on the schedule. Well, it turned out the guy was absolutely right. And Gorbachev pretends he can't speak English.
Yes.
But he clearly can, if forced to, and he certainly understands it. And so he's got an interpreter who is with him all the time, and he's got these other guys that kind of follow him around. One guy had a violin case.
Uh-oh.
And if you bumped him, you got a very funny look, like, you know, don't try that again. But anyway, the speech did go over. He wanted it to go even longer. We finally had to basically, you know, get a hook and get him off the stage. And he was great, but, you know, it just the schedule thing was a problem. The crowd loved him, and he was having a good time. I had a news conference set up that because the speech had gone so long, I cut back to 10 minutes, which, you know, you've dealt with the media enough, Larry, to know that 10 minutes, nothing. Anyway, we get into the room, and I walk up to the podium, and I say, folks, we know we're a little tight for time, so we'll probably have time for two questions.
Uh-oh.
And Gorbachev steps to the podium, and Debbie Knox from Channel 8 in Indianapolis asked the first question about the Iraq War. Took him 12 minutes to answer it. And so I get up to the podium again, and I say, folks, we got to make this next one real quick. And he goes, nyet. You know, he certainly understood what I was saying. And it through the translator, he told me that he was the president and, you know, I should stay out of the way and that he'd make the decision. You know, I sheepishly crawled to the back of the room and he finally did end the thing, but it, too, went way too damn long. And as we're leaving the room, he walks by me and he says something like, "Hey, logo," and the interpreter who's right behind him says, "Dictator." And so, you know, I caught up with him, and I had to walk him to his next event, and he was laughing. I mean, he was pulling my leg. But, Mikhail Gorbachev called me a dictator, and I explained to him that it had nothing to do with I wasn't trying to hurt the press or not be a friend of the press. I was in the television news media for 20 years myself. I just wanted to make sure that he got to his next session.
You should have had a T-shirt made for yourself that said that, dictator.
Oh, I should. I'd have to explain it every time, though, and probably too many people wouldn't take the time to ask why I was called that. You know, the funny thing is he got to that last event, and the thing about Gorbachev is when he decides something is over, it's over. And he was in a public place, basically a hotel, well, the Walden Inn in Greencastle.
Oh.
And at a certain point, he just decided that he had to go. And he headed out a side door, and, you know, the guy with the violin case and all those other guys, I mean, it was like the, it was like the defensive backs for the Green Bay Packers, you know, when Roethlisberger was looking downfield. I mean, they moved fast, and they were right on his tail, and Gorbachev is walking down the streets of Greencastle, Indiana, and these people are doing triple takes.
I'll bet.
Who I think it is? He's got a big splotch on his head. It must be. So it was that was a very interesting day.
What other people have come in that really, I don't know, got your attention that you thought, wow, there's something else?
Well, you know, Wesley Clark came days after he announced his presidential bid. And so we had national news media, and it was a bit of a mess just because he had this upstart presidential campaign and a bunch of very young people who'd never been in a presidential campaign taking over an event that was booked through a speaker's bureau originally and trying to change a lot of the rules at the last minute. And General Clark was just a wonderful guy.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a nervous day just because they were trying to change this rather rigid agenda that we'd set up so that not only would he do the things that DePauw was hoping he'd do, but that the national news media, these folks were flying in from New York, and the Clark campaign was saying he's not going to do any media. Well, you know, that doesn't help a guy who's on a plane who's on his way, and I've spent enough time as a reporter that I know that if they didn't come through and meet with the media, it was there was going to be hell to pay. They were going to
write
terrible stories because, you know, Wesley Clark is running for president, but he doesn't want to answer questions. And we flew to Indiana to ask him questions, and he basically shunned us.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, sometimes the hat that I wear extends beyond DePauw responsibilities, but I thought I had a human obligation to him, even though I wasn't really a Wesley Clark supporter at that point. But just, you know, I knew what was going to happen if he let his campaign staff dictate what they wanted to do, and we did, you know, make it all work out fine. Jason Reitman came right after the Oscars last year.
Oh.
He was nominated for Up in the Air, and
mm-hmm.
he was just a great guy. I mean, you talk about somebody who is, his father is Ivan Reitman, who was the director of Ghostbusters and Stripes, and, you know, you'd think that someone who grew up in that kind of an environment and has had the success he's had would be a bit pretentious, but he was absolutely the most down-to-earth person I think we've hosted. And I could go on and on. We had, you know, Tony Blair was in, and Scotland Yard was on campus for about 5 or 6 days before he even arrived. They brought that armored vehicle so he could move around while he was on campus. And it's really amazing when you get into those situations where somebody is, you know, that kind of a figure. Paul Bremer was the same way, where there was this, you know, Secret Service group on campus for days making sure that he was going to be safe when he arrived
mm-hmm.
at DePauw.
I can recall at the National Conservation Training Center in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, they had the conference with President Clinton and the Middle Eastern leaders at this
mm-hmm.
facility. It's a private government-run facility. It's not public access at all, except maybe once or twice a year. And the Israeli Secret Service were in there like a month before the meeting. And they said the strangest thing was that they never really were formally introduced to these men. But after they were there for just a few days, they'd be walking through the facilities, and they'd run into these guys. They'd just look at them, and they'd go, "Hi, Bob." I mean, they had everybody's name memorized. And he said, it was just creepy. I mean, it was
It's something else. You know, I went to Russia with Billy Graham once, and I didn't realize it at the time. We all had diplomatic visas. I was working for a television station, and I figured I was like everybody else.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, it's interesting when you – well, there was one time I was interviewing Billy Graham on a park bench. We were
mm-hmm.
sitting outside a hotel in Russia, and he was really kind of dodgy. And Billy, and that's what he likes to be called, I really hadn't thought too much about the guy before I got sent to Russia with him. He's a wonderful human being on every level, and he was really kind of evasive. I mean, and you know, kind of a gung-ho, you know, well, the Russians are really trying to do this, and it was when Gorbachev had the glasnost and perestroika, and they were trying to open up society, and
mm-hmm.
he really had a hopeful tone. And then we got back to North Carolina, and I interviewed him in his backyard, and you know, he was quite different. It was much more direct, and you know, he's been there enough that he understands that there's always somebody listening, and there are just certain things you don't, you know, say in public in Russia. But it wasn't until after I got home and I realized we had these diplomatic visas that that I realized we'd gotten away with murder. You know, we were changing money and doing all the things that
Oh, really? You know,
were essentially illegal in Russia. Yeah, but I think because we were viewed as friends of the State Department and friends of Billy Graham, and it's not like we were, you know, trafficking anything or doing anything bad, but I just thought we were journalists, you know, like any other journalist schmucks that would be over there. But
mm-hmm.
we were specialists, special schmucks. We were afforded certain privileges that we weren't aware of until we got off the plane at JFK in New York.
That had to be eye-opening to be in as far away as Russia and to realize how many people around the world love Billy Graham.
It you know, it is, I got to say that in terms of just my personal soul, you know, in terms of just kind of getting your arms around something as amazing as people and spirituality and, you know, religion aside, but I mean just the way mm-hmm. we all live in this world and the fears we have, what flabbergasted me and what really touched me was how these people in Russia, the Muscovites, who were just, well, we were in three or four different cities in Russia, but in place after place after place, when people realized we were Americans, they would flock, and they would, almost weeping, talk about how they feared that we were going to kill them. You know, that
really?
They went to bed every night thinking that we were going to drop a bomb on them, and of course, that's the same thing that we were fed, you know, growing up
mm-hmm.
as kids here, you know, that the Russians had their finger on the trigger, and we had the air raid drills, and we had to get under our desks when we were growing up in the 60s, and
mm-hmm.
you know, you realize that two governments can be at odds with each other and have these disputes that lead to bigger disputes and sometimes horrific things, but people are basically all the same, and they're the other interesting thing I think was that you could see even then, in 1988, that there was a great chasm between the young and the old. The older Russians didn't want communism to go away. They were used to the system in which, you know, if you had a potato farm, you got paid whether you grew potatoes or you didn't grow potatoes. And there was great fear of change, that what's going to happen if these guarantees go away and when we're in a free market economy. The young people were getting Beatle records, and you remember that Paul McCartney record that was released only in Russia back then.
Right.
But there was this great hunger for all things American and Western, and they wanted to wear our jeans. They were reading Rolling Stone magazines that were smuggled into the country. I mean, I asked some Russians, you know, who's Todd Rundgren? American record producer. I mean, they knew everybody. And, you know, you were saying earlier, kids don't know who he is.
Right.
It was really amazing, and it you know, it spoke to the power of the system we have. We have flaws, obviously, in our system, but the idea that you can live the life you want and do what you want with your life in terms of your work and your free time, and if you work harder, you might have more money, you might have things that would reward you for that work. Those were all very attractive things to the young people and very scary things to the older people. And I think, you know, while government leaders and some of the initiatives we had pushed the Russians into changing, I think change was inevitable, just as we're seeing in other countries around the world. I mean, people have access, especially today, to communication that was unthought, you know, unimaginable 8 years ago. And as silly as Twitter can be, or you know some of these other things, they are powerful tools.
Yes, they are.
Used in the right way. What you're doing. I mean, you've got people around the world listening on the internet to your program, and that's 10 years ago, if we had a conversation about this, I would have said, Larry, you know, go see somebody. You've got a problem with your brain.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I do, but anyway.
You don't, but, you know, growing up, if you didn't have a printing press, if you didn't have a broadcast tower, you didn't participate. It was a communication world that was dominated by people who had money and who had access to things that were needed to produce newspapers and broadcasts. That's lots of equipment, printing presses, staffs, budgets, but we're in a world of narrowcasting where people can, you know, find those things they really are interested in, and they've got a voice, and they've got a place to listen, and they've got things they can follow. And so it's not about getting a mass audience anymore. It's about serving people with information that pertains to their individual lives.
Well, it is, and it's, I mean, it's such an honor to be able to do something like we're doing tonight, and so easily, and to reach such an audience like I mentioned earlier, around the world. We do. We have listeners in Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, England. In fact, we can, believe it or not, there's a guy that's going to mow a golf course tomorrow that will listen to this show on his iPod. So,
holy cow.
That's the community.
Watch out for that squirrel.
Yeah, really. That's what I tell. We were. You mentioned earlier about the Paul McCartney. You had a chance to interview Paul McCartney. I didn't like
that. Yeah, it was actually, I've done a lot of one-on-one interviews in my life, but I think, you know, the only people that get one-on-ones with Paul McCartney are Barbara Walters and people of that ilk.
Right.
When he came to Indianapolis in 1989, it was the Flowers in the Dirt tour,
mm-hmm.
and he played two nights in Indianapolis, and the first night they got into town and they had a news conference at Marcus Square Arena, the old venue downtown, and of course I've been a Beatle fan all my life, huge Beatle fan, and especially a big Paul McCartney fan.
Mm-hmm.
And we, the station sent me down there to do it. And I think the news conference was at, I was anchoring the 5:30 news then. I think the news conference was like at 4:30. And I was probably 29 years old at the time. And I haven't really grown up. I mean, I probably would do the same thing today, but I told the news director, I will get back. We had to drive it back because we didn't have a live truck down there.
Mm-hmm.
We'll cover the news conference. I will drive it back, and we'll have it as the lead story at 5:30. And we actually hit it. I mean, we actually did it.
That's amazing.
It wasn't a big story, but we had some sound, and we had McCartney. But the funny thing is, I'm in this room, and there are probably like 8 or 12 other reporters, all local folks. Mm-hmm. There might have been a couple of national folks that were following McCartney, but the reporters are gathered and we're waiting for McCartney. All of a sudden the door opens and there's Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
And everybody freezes. I mean, it's like, I don't want to overstate it, but, you know, it's like if Bigfoot walked into a room.
He's a Beatle.
You know, or if, yeah, but you've seen him. I mean, his face and that smile and the way look, that is all embedded in your mind because you've mm-hmm. seen the videos and listened to the records. But there he is, you know, just a few feet away from you, and sits down and kind of tussles his hair and, hey, how you doing? And everybody froze. And luckily I had a question at the ready.
Yeah.
So I got the first question, and I asked him if he had any recollections of the Beatles' trip to Indianapolis in 1964, and he remembered, you know, Ringo disappearing with a state trooper for a while.
Yeah.
But it was pretty amazing, you know, just to be in a room with Paul McCartney, and at the same time, you know, I was sweating bullets because I knew I had to run back with his tape and do a newscast, and I wanted to put something on the air that was, you know, reflective of what we did in the room. But the problem with Paul McCartney, if there's a problem, is that he's been asked every question in the world 65,000 times.
Yeah.
And he's almost like a CNC, you know, the old toy where you pull the string and the horse goes,
meow. Yeah, absolutely.
He just kind of, he gives you the same answer. So The Ringo question was actually good. The Beatles in Indianapolis in 1964, because I don't think he'd really thought about that for a long time. But the problem with interviewing him and some other people that just do it all the time is that they get very rehearsed. They're very kind of, I wouldn't say careful with their responses, but they, you know, they're not going to give you too much because it's what they do.
Yeah, well, they've had a chance to think about these answers so they can hone them. So they have their timing perfected and their their comedic.
They're not going to pull a Charlie Sheen. Yeah, they're not going to go in 2020 and just, you know, start talking about how they're warlocks.
Yeah, no, they want to have long careers, so that's all about.
That's a way to shorten your career, I think.
Oh my Lord, he's doing a fine job of that, I'll tell you. You have a pretty cool job, Ken.
Well, thank you, Larry. Thank you. And I would urge your listeners, if they're ever in the area, and we have people that drive from Florida.
Mm-hmm.
When we had Todd Rundgren as an oven lecturer, we had people from all over the country come in. But these events are free and open to the public, and we welcome anybody. So if you're ever in the area, come to depaul.edu and check out our site. We announce the things there, and there's usually something coming up, and you're welcome to come.
Well, I'll tell you, living not far from DePaul, just on the outskirts of Greencastle, I think DePaul University should feel quite lucky to have Ken Owen taking care of the responsibilities that you do, because they couldn't be in any better hands.
Well, you're a good man, Larry. Thank you. And thanks for giving me a platform tonight. This has been really nice. I feel kind of sheepish given your guest list that it's me tonight, but I thank you and your listeners for putting up with me.
Oh, no, it's fantastic. Believe me, I think we've just basically touched the iceberg, because I didn't have a chance. I wanted to know about Margaret Thatcher, and there was a couple others that you'd mentioned, that, and the Tony Blair. I have the feeling that when Tony Blair was in town, there might have been a small party. He seemed like the fun-loving type.
Oh, yeah. You know, I will say this about him. He did tell our students, there was a little session where he met with about 20 students before the speech,
mm-hmm.
that when he was in college, he had long hair, and he loved David Bowie. And, I think Tony probably had a pretty eventful youth.
I'll bet he did.
In terms of social life. And, yeah, I think he's slowed down quite a bit now, as we all have, but... you could tell that there was a time when, yes, that was a big part of his life.
We want to thank Ken Owen for being part of our show tonight. And gosh, fantastic guest. We've got to have Ken back on. We want to remind everyone, check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and a brand new Facebook page. You get our new Facebook page, don't you, Ken? Larry the Animal
Guy. I do, yes.
Friends. Filled with photos and information. We've got these nature quizzes now that everybody seems to love, so we've been doing that. Larry the Animal Guy and Friends. Say you want to be a member, and we'll confirm you. And also, a big thank you to Tire Service Plus and owner Jerry Jones, taking care of America's auto maintenance needs. They keep our animal truck on the road. Boy, they do a good job, traveling thousands and thousands of miles with our wild animal ambassadors. Give them a call, 317-243-0700. In fact, the wild animal ambassadors will be going to the remote jungles of Gaston, Indiana. You ever been up there, Ken?
I have not.
What
part of the state is that?
Well, it's north of Muncie, a little burg, a little community. I can remember years ago that we drove all the way up there. It was like 20 degrees below zero, and we arrived at the school, and the school was closed. That's before they had the mass communication they do now, school closings. And we looked across this snow-covered field, and here come these two little kids in their parks, and they're on Eskimo, walking up saying, "There's no school today." I said, "Well, we figured it out, but thanks for the thought." It was.
Did you say Gaston or Gas City?
Gaston.
Did you cut out?
Yeah.
Gaston. No, I don't know Gaston. I do know Gas City.
Well, it's a wonderful place. Great show, Ken. Thank you. It was absolutely fantastic.
Larry, thank you.
I really
enjoyed being here anytime.
Oh, man. You might regret those words.
Never.
Good job, Dr. Henry Day.
Ken, it's great to hear your voice again.
I was going to say you're doing a good thing for animals. Yeah, the news broadcast here in Indianapolis, when Ken Owen went to DePaul, they gained a great guy, but the news stations here in Indianapolis, they lost a tremendous personality. Cause,
I have to agree.
He was quite the anchor, and yeah. But I'm just glad he's a good friend. Big thank you to Melissa Hubby and Wayne Larson, as always, taking care of the technical responsibilities. Next week, Chris Franz from Talking Heads. Have a great week, everybody. You have been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.